book study, the goal of this recording is to increase our collective knowledge of the book Alcoholics Anonymous by sharing with each other. I'm Julia, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Julia. I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stephanie.
So today we're going to be talking about Bill's story, which is chapter one in the big book. It starts on page one. Stephanie's going to tell us a little more about Bill now and who he was.
That's right. A little bit about Bill, just a little bit of his history, because it's good to get to know about this guy that left his story in the book for us to read. Bill's born on November 26th of 1895, which kind of blows my mind that it was that long ago, in East Dorset, Vermont. His parents were Emily and Gilman Wilson, and he was born in Mount Elias Inn and Tavern. So he was born right behind this tavern, which is crazy to me. His grandfather, William C. Wilson, was an alcoholic as well. And he got sober after having a religious experience under this drug. It's called psilocybin, but actually it's kind of like mushrooms. So he's probably having a little bit of his spiritual experience. It's probably a hallucination of some sort. But nonetheless, it got him sober. Sadly, his parents abandoned he and his sister after they were born, which is so sad to me. His dad left on a business trip, never to return, and mom went to Vermont to study osteopathic medicine. So he was raised by his mom's grandparents, Fayette and Ella Griffith. And he didn't really love academics, but he spent months trying to, like, he got obsessive, right? Trying to, like, carve this boomerang, and he wanted to carve boomerangs so he could hunt. And I think he finally did get one. He met Lois in 1913, and he was sailing in Vermont. And then he started at Norwich University, but left after a second semester because of depression and anxiety. So he was already struggling with those things. And he did return to school, but then he got suspended. So, let's see. In June 1916, he went into the Vermont National Guard. And then he got married on January 24th of 1918. And Julia's going to share some fun facts about Bill.
All right. There are four of them are fun. One of them is not so fun. But, okay. As Stephanie mentioned, he was born behind a bar in the middle of a snowstorm, which is pretty ironic for an alcoholic, right? And his mom, who she mentioned was studying osteopathic medicine, was one of the first women to graduate from Harvard with a degree, which I think is just fascinating. Bill experienced a lot of depression, and his first bout of it started at age 11 when his parents left. He had a younger sister, Dorothy, 4 years younger than him. And he had another very serious bout of depression when he was 18. His high school sweetheart actually died. And that's kind of when he first experienced, like, the really intense depression. He was married to his wife, Lois, for 53 years and died on their 53rd wedding anniversary on January 24th of 1971. Bill and Lois never had kids. Bill desperately wanted them, but Lois went through a series of ectopic pregnancies. They tried to adopt several times, but it would always get to the point in the adoption where they would find out Bill was drunk or drinking, so that always put a kibosh on that. And then last fun fact, Bill was offered an honorary law degree later in his life from Yale, but declined it because of the traditions which he wrote. So there's your fun facts about Bill.
Yeah, interesting stuff. So with Bill's story, one of the values of the big book is for us to see ourselves in the disease of alcoholism. At A's beginning, Bill W. knew the value of sharing his story with others, and it is in this big book as the first study that helps us to identify with Bill's journey, see how we can make a recovery, and that we can gain hope that we can have recovery if we were willing. Bill's story is made up of basically kind of two sections. The first part is the first, you know, pages 1 through 8 is kind of like the problem, the progression of the disease. And pages 9 through 16 is the solution that he found. You know, in the story, lots of times I wouldn't identify with Bill. I didn't go to law school. I don't know anything about numbers and stockbroking and what have you. But the point of it is for us to be able to see our story as an alcoholic, as an addiction, the way he thinks, the way he acts, and the way he drinks. So I'm going to walk through some key phrases that help us identify with Bill and his progression. I have to take a deep breath. I'm nervous. So I'm just gonna kind of point out some phrases in the book that kind of really helped me identify, and hopefully it'll help you guys identify with Bill's story and especially his progression. So I'm gonna speak mostly about his progression, the first half of the book, and Julia's gonna take over the solution, the good part. So, you know, right away on page one, There's a phrase that says, here was love, applause, war, and moments of sublime intervals, hilarious. I was part of life at last. So basically, he was in the, they were getting back from, he was in the,
World War One.
He got back and he found alcohol and it was fun. I can totally relate to the fact that alcohol was fun. When I first drank, I'm like, this is good. I feel good. You know, what have you. But even in the first paragraph, it says, I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning this drink. So I was talking to my sponsor about that. He comes from an Irish background, and his grandfather died of alcoholism. So clearly, there were some warnings already set in place for him that he just didn't pay any attention to. He thought he was immune to it. And then right in the middle of page one, it says, here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. And the pot there is a pot of beer. So, and I believe in that one, it's kind of like an identification of a spiritual experience for him. Even if he didn't realize it or not, it was an ominous warning which he failed to hear. And on the bottom of the page it says, my talent of leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises and I would manage with the utmost assurance. That ego is showing up big time. Big time. So then Bill decides on page two that he's going to give it a go in law and study law. He's going to make some money, and that's when he really started to drink. He said his drive for success was on. He proved to the world that he was important. But potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. As one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed his wife. So I identify with that because he knew he was a potential alcoholic, but there was a lot of denial, and I imagine a lot of manipulation. And his wife probably mentioned some things, and he's like, no, I'm good. And even when he was saying in part of it that men come up with their best ideas when they're drinking. So he was just like, it's okay, I'm gonna do my best work when I'm drinking. I must be a genius. So that's what geniuses do. So let's see where I'm at. In page two, he got interested in stockbroking and what have you. And so he came up with this idea that he's gonna make more money. And he was trying to persuade his broker friends that he had some really good ideas. And they weren't quite buying what he had to sell. So he basically says, I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. And so basically, they gave up all their possessions. I'm trying to imagine Lois and all this going, okay, we're going to do that now. And they rode off on a motorcycle, and the sidecar stuff with tent, blankets, and a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of financial reference services. Our friends thought it was lunacy. Commission should be appointed. So funny to me that he has like a change of clothes, and he has just a couple things, but he has three huge volumes of financial stuff, which just is obsession. You know, as alcoholics, we just get obsessed about things. Just one train of thought, which is just so crazy to me. Excuse me. So on page three, it says, for the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way, I had arrived. So basically he got back and convinced people that he had some good ideas. And he just thought that he had arrived. And he was making all kinds of money. And he was just having a good old time. And drinking had taken an important part of his life, and he made a host of fair weather friends. I've made a host of fair weather friends when I'm drinking, especially, you know, just at a bar or whatever. I just have a whole bunch of friends for that night. I mean, just, you know, I really relate to that so much. Just, you were just having a good time when we're drinking. Then he says towards the bottom of page three, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and night, almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in a sumptuous apartment, but that there had been no real infidelity. So basically at that point, people were noticing more and more that he was drinking, that it was affecting his life. And his fair weather friends decided that he was not part of the company that they wanted to keep either. And he just decided to that's when drinking became something that he was just doing by himself. And that's the progression. Now on page 4, it talks about how he decided that he was going to go into golfing. And he was going to be the greatest golfer. And he got a really great jacket, and he was looking very well-to-do. And he just thought he was such a bigwig. His ego was really just taking over. And the local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Isn't it funny when we're drinking how we just don't see how foolish we could look? And I really identified with that. Just the center of the universe is self-centeredness and just thinking that you're doing everything really, really well. And the other people are just kind of rolling their eyes going, I know what's up with that guy. This is very interesting to me. So in 1929 then, that's when all hell broke loose. And the market basically crashed. And Bill had a solution for that. You know, he had friends that were, there were people that were jumping out of windows in the buildings and just going crazy. Everybody had lost their money. And Bill's response to it was that he was disgusted. He said he would not jump, and I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. And as I drank, the old fierce determination to come back, to win, would come back. And that just cracks me up because he's like, he knew what he had to do to escape all this, you know, this depression and this shock and horror of losing all this money. He was like, I'm just going to drink. And once you start drinking, then you come up with these ideas. Like, here I go. I'm gonna be a winner. It has nothing to do with me. Because he was, you know, he was just in denial about everything. So after the market crash, he telephoned a friend in Montreal. And he decided to go to Canada. And he felt like Napoleon returning from Elba, St. Helena for me. And Julia's going to talk a little bit about that. But drinking caught up with him again, and a generous friend had to let him go. This time we stayed broke. I think about geographical changes and how, as alcoholics, we escape. And sometimes we actually move, thinking that drinking won't follow us. I know that happened for me. So,
can I talk about the Napoleon?
Oh, yeah, talk about the Napoleon.
So I never understood what that meant when they said the Napoleon in St. Helena, so I looked it up. So Napoleon, 1813 in France, was defeated. His army was defeated, and they took Napoleon and put him on this island called Elba, and they're like, oh, well, fine, he's out in the ocean, he'll be fine. 11 months later, he marches back to France with an army that he had built up in Elba, and they're like, shoot, so they fight a bunch. And then the second time they capture Napoleon, they take him and put him on St. Helena, which is this super deserted island in the middle of nowhere. So basically he's saying, I'm going to come back with a vengeance. I got you. Like, our alcoholic thoughts is like, oh, you're going to put me on an island? Well, I'll come back with an army. And, like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to get caught. So that's what that reference is, mm-hmm. in case any of you were wondering, because I was definitely wondering. So, yeah.
Yeah. But what an ego, right? Yeah. it just blows my mind. And I really can relate to that. I mean, there's so many times where I just thought, no, I'm fine. That's not going to happen to me or what have you. It's you know, I'm going to be good. Everything's going to be good. But then, you know, this time they stayed broke. That's when his drinking really, really started to turn. We can just identify with that progression. On the bottom of the page, on page 4, it says, mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk, and I became an unwelcome hanger-on at the brokerage places. So I imagine Bill, again, just not really realizing the enormity of his problem and trying to go into the brokerage center and hang out with people, and they're probably just like, can you just please go home? I just, you know, it makes me feel sad, but But then I understand the fact that we're just kind of, that denial that just happens is baffling. In the second paragraph on page 5, you know, he's talking about how he's making bathtub gin and 2 bottles a day and often 3 to get to be routine. You know, he'd wake up in the morning shaking violently, and it says a tumbler full of gin followed by a half dozen bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were many periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. I mean, having to drink before eating, before being able to eat, and the insanity of it all, and being able to go for a couple of days, and, you know, as obviously, you know, Lois needs some Al-Anon. That the periods of sobriety, which, you know, renewing his wife's hope, I know that to be the case for many, many of us, when we have some periods of sobriety, and then people think we're getting better, and we don't understand the disease. Why would anybody else understand the disease? So that's the insanity of it all. There was an interesting story about in the 4th paragraph, he said, then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were on the low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. When I went on a prodigious, I can never say that word, bender, and that chance vanished. It's really interesting to me. I read a little bit about that story. It was during Prohibition, and Bill was previously known for putting together deals. Some old friends asked him if he would help with the deal, and they really were concerned if he could stay sober, and he told them not to worry about that. Again, ego. After working months to come up with the deal, someone offered him a taste of a unique beverage that he hadn't had before in the form of Applejack. And Bill at first refused to drink it, but then someone said, you know, you've never had this one before. It's really special. And then that alcoholic brain takes mm-hmm. a sip, and he was off for the races, mm-hmm. You know, triggering that allergy. And basically, he lost his chance. I mean, it's sad. Then he woke up, and this had to be stopped, he thought. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. It was through forever. But before then, he had written lots of sweet promises to his wife and happily observed this time that she observed that he meant business. And so he did. That's when he's trying to use willpower, right? He's trying to use whatever he could, his fierce determination, to not drink. But whenever the race of willpower and obsession of the mind are competing, the obsession always wins. Shortly afterwards, he came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where is my high resolve? I mean, he was completely baffled. I simply don't know. I hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. When we drink, we tend to question our sanity. I know I did. I just thought, I'm not going to drink. I have this big resolve. I'm just not going to do it anymore. I can do it. I cannot have to drink. And then you drink. Then you think you're crazy. It's just part of the disease. And what's really funny, in the top of page 6, you know, when he decided that he was going to try to quit again and use his willpower, his confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. He'd laugh at gin mills. And now I had what it take. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how this happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. Boy, I really relate to that. You know, you just think that you have this willpower and you've done really good. He probably had a few weeks under his belt, and he's like, I got this. And then that addictive brain gets talking to you. And it starts telling you, you know, you've done this for a couple of weeks. Your willpower is obviously working. So So you could probably have a drink and you'd probably be okay. And then all of a sudden you have a drink and then all of a sudden you're just going, well, F it. I might as well get good and drunk anyways and I'll start again tomorrow. I really relate to that. In the second paragraph, he said, my brain raced uncontrollably and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck. For me, it was scarcely daylight. Then he's saying, should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles in oblivion. So he's thinking, I think this is so bad. This is so hard. I think I just might kill myself. And then he settles down a little bit and he's like, well, I could kill myself or I could just go ahead and get some gin and just check out for a little bit. It seems crazy to other people. It seems pretty normal to me. On the bottom of the page, it says, then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. Then a doctor came in with a heavy sedative. The next day found me drinking both on gin and the sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks, and people feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. Bill was in constant oblivion, and he did so much to manage everything that couldn't be managed. He moved his bed, for God's sake, so he wouldn't fall out. I mean, drinking around the clock and forgetting to eat. I mean, that's the insanity of the disease. And the second part the second paragraph on page 7, it says, I met a kind doctor who explained that certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. So belladonna was given, much like in detox treatment centers now, they give you Valium. Belladonna was used then, but it wasn't a good drug. It really was hard to tolerate. And hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped a lot. Hydrotherapy was basically where they lay you on a table and put in cold water and hot water on you, so he was a clean drunk, basically. And I can sense this relief in his brain. He's starting to understand that he has a disease. He just doesn't know what to do about it. So he just... I can identify with the fact that he was relieved knowing it was a disease and that he's like, all right, I got this, I understand it now. I'm kind of off the hook a little bit and now I'm going to take care of it because my self-will, my self-knowledge is going to take care of the thing. I mean, just like me and my stack of books, I figured I'd have some answers. If I study enough about it, I'll understand how to get well. And basically the next sentence, but it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. This is where Canal hand things off to Julia. It does feel good, to be relieved to know that you have a disease, and it definitely soothes Bill. He knows he's powerless. He's starting to understand he's powerless. And he also knows now that willpower doesn't work. And he knew he wasn't sinful. He knew he wasn't a bad person. And he thought he had it licked. But just because you know it doesn't solve the problem, and knowledge isn't the cure. And soon Bill finds out how much it's not the cure.
So he's left with this low point in his life, right? So Bill is basically of the understanding that he's an alcoholic, but there's really not much you can do for him. His willpower isn't working. So this, just a little context, this is in 1933 when he first meets Dr. Silkworth. And Silkworth tells him about the disease of alcoholism and tells him, it's not just, it's a physical allergy and it's like an obsession, the two parts of it. So he goes to towns twice. The first time was the summer of 1933, and that's what they're talking here about on page 7. And then as we go on to page 8, it kind of starts all of a sudden, it talks about the solution, right, how he got out of it. But before we get there quick, no words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. I can totally identify with that feeling of having just like tar wrapped around your soul. Like, Bill is clearly from his career. He is a self-made man. He's optimistic. He's hardworking. I mean, he went through all those little gigs as a stockbroker, and he has a great drive for success, and yet he can't figure out how to quit drinking. And how dark it is before the dawn. As someone who has depression, I can totally relate to like that idea of like complete oblivion, but not knowing how to solve my problems and just feeling hopeless. And then boom, all of a sudden in the middle of page 8, he was catapulted into a new dimension, fourth dimension of existence. And so what had happened, I'm sure some of you have heard of Ebbie Thatcher. So summer of 1934, he goes back, Bill Wilson gets back into towns, but how he gets there, he comes out of towns, right? He gets there, comes out, and Bill is at home drinking gin, or whatever he's drinking, and he's just getting drunk and can't figure out why he's getting drunk, and his friend Ebbie calls him. Ebbie Thatcher was a childhood friend. His wife, Bill's wife Lois, actually grew up with him in Vermont playing together. And Ebbie was from a really prominent family in the East. They were really rich. They basically kicked him out and said, Ebbie, you're too drunk. Stop embarrassing us. Go stay at the summer cabin. At the summer cabin, he like tried to fix the place up. He wound up having this incident where he was shooting at the wall because of the pigeons. And then the police were called, blah, blah, blah. And Ebbie shows up to court, and these two guys from the Oxford group show up and stand up for him, and basically he gets out of his like big trouble because his two friends from the Oxford group came. So I did a little bit of research on the Oxford group, because most of AA comes from, you know, some of the tenets of the Oxford group, and I was like, I don't know what that is. So the Oxford group was a kind of, I'll call it a religious movement, but it really wasn't. It was like a spiritual movement. People of different kind of Christianities coming together. It was based out of a Lutheran something or other, but their idea, they had four main ideas that the moral standards, absolute honesty, absolute purity, unselfishness, and love, which I think you can kind of find throughout the principles and steps of AA. But these guys had formed a group and would meet on a regular basis to be spiritually reborn. The Oxford group defined sin as anything that kept one from God or from one another. So anyway, these groups are meeting. They have these ideas that, you know, they're going to share their sins and temptations with another Christian. I look at that as step 4 and 5, right? Surrender our life, past, present, and future, into God's keeping and direction. 1, 2, and 3, right? 11 and 12. Restitution to all whom we have wronged, directly or indirectly. 8 and 9. And listening for God's guidance and carrying it out. 11, 12, yeah? So that's the Oxford group stuff, but I can totally see how Bill took that and wove it into the 12 steps. So anyway, Ebbie calls up Bill. Bill's drunk. He's like super wasted in his life. And Ebbie's like, hey, I've got really, like, I want to come see you, right? I've had this experience. And Bill's like, oh, great. Ha ha, my old drinking buddy. Like, I really need a friend. And I'm trying to picture my last couple of years of drinking. And I usually drank alone in the living room, right? If one of my friends from college that I partied with had called me up and said, hey, can I come over? I'd be like, sure. And I would be sitting there with the vodka on the table. I can just see it now, Bill sitting there and being like, yeah, come on over. I could use a friend. And he doesn't know what he's in for. So Ebbie comes in, shows up, and says he was sober, top of page 9. And there he was, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something different about his eyes. How many of us know exactly what that looks like as we watch people come in and out of this room? It's so cool. And then Ebbie's like, I've got religion. Bill's like, whoa, okay. Like, so then there's this process where they talk and talk and talk. And Bill listens to Ebbie talk about his spiritual experience. And he sees that Ebbie is truly better. And in the beginning of Bill's story, he talks about that poem written on the gravestone. And he talks about how he was much moved at the Winchester Cathedral. So this was before he got sober. He's like, what, like, in his early 20s over there in World War I. And all of a sudden that experience came flooding back to him as a sudden spiritual experience. And Bill W. was one of the people that didn't have a gradual spiritual experience. He had a boom right there one. And as Ebbie was talking, it reminded him of his grandfather and how his grandfather kind of talked about religion when he was growing up, and I can relate to this. I had a dad who talked about spirituality all the time, and it made so much more sense to me than the religious aspect I was raised in. And so he's hearing this from Ebby. He's kind of like on the fence, and I love how he describes how he goes through the thought process. I think a lot of us as alcoholics who have had some sort of faith or background do, we're kind of at the point where we're hopeless. We're like, why is all this crappy stuff happening in the world? Like, and we're going back and forth, teetering on the scale. Is there a God? Is there not a God? You know? And basically, Bill decides that he would have God. So, or his higher power, as we can say. He saw that here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. He saw that his friend, who had had just as much problem drinking as he had found a solution, and he just has this experience. He'd always believed in a power greater than myself, but he couldn't reconcile some of that other stuff that we think of when it comes to religion. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how Ebby looked. He says, my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. Those are all ways of saying that he has gone through some sort of spiritual experience, that Ebby has gone through something profound. And Ebby and Bill continue to talk, and Bill's kind of combating what Ebby says. And finally, Ebby just gets so frustrated about this conversation with God. He's like, why don't you just choose your own conception of God? And it wasn't like this magical, like, nice little sponsor being like, why don't you choose your... It was like, he was like pissed off. He was like, come on, Bill, get it. So that's really the changing point where not only... Bill has admitted a long time ago he was powerless over alcohol. He hasn't yet admitted his life was unmanageable up to this point. So he's done like the first half of step one. And here's where we see in his story that he does kind of one, two, and three. Would I have it? Of course I would. God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. So this idea that he's licked with alcohol, he's got to find a solution. This one seems like it could be okay. And then on page 13, he literally goes through the steps. It's really funny how quickly he goes through the steps with Ebby. So this is about December 14th of 1934 in Towns Hospital. And Ebby comes back and goes through all the steps with Bill, kind of, and that's how they don't have the steps yet, but this is kind of, you can see how the Oxford group stuff kind of aligns with how Bill went through the steps with Ebby. And so all of page 13 has step 3, 4, 5, 11. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking for direction and strength, and belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honest humility to establish and maintain new order of things were essential requirements. So, I mean, a lot of the second half of the story describes his spiritual experience. And it emphasizes the importance of enlarging and perfecting your spiritual life, right? Let's see, we're kind of coming up on time here. And I think he does a really good job in the last couple of pages of describing the miracle that happened. And I step back and think about this. Bill had no AA to go to. Bill was an alcoholic. He knew he was an alcoholic. There was no solution for him. And to have found this with Ebby, and to come into this place of wanting to help other alcoholics, that's the other key part of the second half of the story, is that he realized that in order to keep his sobriety, he had to share the message with other alcoholics. And you know, all of this is occurring over a period of like a year and a half, and I don't know how many of you know the story of how he met Dr. Bob, but he was in the hotel, he wanted a drink, he went to a phone booth and started looking through the phone books, trying to call someone to work with an alcoholic. He wound up talking to Dr. Bob, who was, they had gone to the Oxford group together at some point, and that kept him sober. But it's pretty amazing that the founder, Bill W., one of the founders of AA, like, his story is about exactly how we feel and think, and the problem and the progression of the disease, and then the absolute spiritual solution. So they placed, Bill, you know, wrote the 12 steps and 12 traditions. They worked through that, which later became Alcoholics Anonymous. And then they place Bill's story, I think, in this book very specifically. First, they give the doctor's opinion. So it's kind of like Bill's experience, where he goes to Dr. Silkworth, hears all about his, you know, alcoholism, obsession, and allergy. And then I don't think it's a mistake that the chapter after it is called There Is a Solution. So Bill's story is right in the middle of there because I think that they want people to be able to relate to what it's like to be an alcoholic. And I don't know about you, but after reading the story, I'm like, yeah, I'm all of those things. Mm-hmm. So thanks for listening. That's all I got.
Yeah, thanks.